Hello, everyone. Welcome to Things We Said Today, in a way, a solar eclipse edition. The solar eclipse of 2024 just ended, and now here we are with another show. And I got to take these off because, I mean, as great as they are to look at the sun, they really are blackout flash. You can't see anything. Ah, there you are. Darren DeVivo with you here, and welcome to Things We Said Today. Minutes after the solar eclipse is over, we're with you with another show. I'm from WFUV Radio. Been at WFUV now for 40 years. Can be heard Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday nights, and Saturday afternoons. And as is the case every other week, I'm joined by my good friend Ken Michaels. Ken, you know from right now his syndicated radio show, Every Little Thing. Ken also has a YouTube channel called Ken Michaels Radio, which is loaded with great interviews. He's been in broadcasting just in general for over 40 years. Most of that dabbling in the Beatle world. And besides this show, this podcast, he is a co-host of Talk More Tom, which is a podcast that concentrates on the solo years of the four Beatles. And Ken, great to see you. How are you?
It's great to be with you, Darren, and you, Alan.
Right now, Alan's world is the McCartney Legacy. Alan and Adrian Sinclair wrote the McCartney Legacy, Volume 1, 1969 to 1973. That was published in 2002.
22.
Boy, the years are flying by. 2022 and Volume 2, covering the years 1974 to 1980, will be out in December. Long before the McCartney Legacy series started, Alan's been a music critic and a journalist for decades, and we worked for the New York Times in the classical music department, has written several other books on the Beatles from years past, and joins us here on Things We Said Today. How are you, Alan?
I'm fine, Darren. Good to see you again, and Ken.
And, I can't see you if I put these back on. But now that I read my notes, cheat sheet here, we have a very special show for you today because we have a special guest. I'll tell you about her in a few minutes. But first, let's throw it over to Ken for the news. Ken?
Okay. Thank you, Darren. Well, the first news item is as fresh as could be news-wise because we found out about this today. We're doing this show on April the 8th, and we learned that Ringo Starr's new song, February Sky, will be coming out this Friday for streaming and downloading on all platforms. February Sky is part of his four-song EP coming out called Crooked Boy, which will be coming out first on Record Store Day. That's April the 20th on limited edition marble vinyl. In addition to that, because people are questioning, what about all the other formats? On April the 26th, the EP will be released digitally. And on May the 31st, the EP will come out on black vinyl and CD. Now, the EP on black vinyl and the CD release, you can now pre-order. In addition to all that, there is an exclusive version of February Sky on red vinyl 7-inch as a single, which is you can only get at the Amoeba Music music store. At the Amoeba Music Store in Hollywood. And that's on April the 18th. So all this excitement, four new songs coming from Ringo that we'll be hearing very soon. But the first song of the four, February Sky, we'll be hearing online this coming February. And I'm excited.
And the Amoeba single is going to be given out. They're going to play the EP. They're going to have an in-store play of the EP. And I guess, yeah, they'll sell the single. And one of the other songs on the EP, I don't know which one, I forget, is a B-side. So you're going to get half the EP if you're at Amoeba in Hollywood. What's the date again? April...
That is April 18th.
And you can't get it online or anything. I've tried to see if there's ways you can order it, but
Lucky people that live near the Amoeba store.
You know,
Okay,
it's a
also.
little odd to have, if we go from the days of when the Beatles didn't put singles on albums because they didn't want you to have to buy the same track again if you bought the single and then you go buy the album. If you put out a single from an EP, you're putting out half the EP. So I don't understand it as a marketing thing. I mean, why not just put out the whole EP all at once? Why put out a single from an EP?
It's almost like I think that the actual grooves, the music, is secondary to this collectible, this red vinyl single souvenir of this Ringo event at Amoeba.
Okay.
That, throw it on the turntable once or twice and then put it away and wait for the full EP to come out. I'm assuming that's.
Okay.
To me, it's more of trying to appeal to the collector that has to buy everything. That's what it's been all about. Putting out different versions, whether it's vinyl, CD, different colored vinyl. There are fans out there that gobble all that stuff up.
Do you think that the collector who has to have everything is at this point aging into a fixed income kind of, period in their life where they can't buy everything? Why didn't they put out all this stuff in the 60s when everybody had the money and could buy it? And it was also cheaper.
I don't know. I guess they're figuring that's the market that they're going for. And in the case of someone like McCartney, as you know, he puts out many different versions of his albums. And
Suitcases.
yeah, when I and Darren went to the Red and Blue Now and Then event in New York City, I asked our promotions guy whether or not this is Paul's idea to do all this stuff. He said, no, it's all the record company. Paul just signs off on it. So they're looking for ways to sell these records more. If you've got a more limited number of people that are going to buy it, that's why you could sell more copies to those limited people.
Okay.
That's how I look at it, There are fans out there that we know that have to have all these things. Some of them happen to be part of this show.
Well, there's that.
Must say that the Mind Games box set is being delayed now until July. This is on the John Lennon website. Went from June to July. They're still saying 72 tracks, 6 CDs, 2 Blu-rays, new stereo and Dolby Atmos mixes. Okay, it's not that much longer of a wait. I'm sure it's going to be great, just like Plastic Ono Band and Imagine were. The Beatles' classic song Blackbird from the White Album has just been covered by Beyoncé for her new album of country music called Cowboy Carter. But it's much more than just a cover. She actually is using Paul's acoustic guitar playing from the original Beatles recording for her version. Paul gave her ble gave his blessing. Paul gave his blessing for this, and he says, I am so happy with Beyoncé's version of my song Blackbird. I think she does a magnificent version of it, and it reinforces the civil rights message that inspired me to write the song in the first place. I think Beyoncé has done a fab version and would urge anyone who has not heard it yet to check it out. You are going to love it. Have either of you heard it?
Nice vocal harmonies on it. I mean,
Yes.
gotta say that, it didn't depart in insane ways as cover versions sometimes do. It kept pretty close to the song, which I guess it would have to do if you're using Paul's guitar part as the spine of it. Although
Right.
eventually the guitar part becomes less prominent as more vocals come in, So I haven't heard the rest of the album. I've only heard that track.
Yeah. Well, it kind of caught me by surprise. I wasn't expecting it to have the same backing, as the Beatles version. But Beyonce sounds great on it, and like you said, really good harmonies there. You should check it out.
Do you think they sent her the guitar part from the multi-track, or she just got it off the record as it was?
I would
She.
hope that it would be from the multi-track. I mean, she's Beyonce. She's powerful. She can ask for these things.
Right. But because no one said, he's only said, well, she asked me and I said, sure. He hasn't, didn't, he, no one's talked about the details of how the track was made, actually, and what the components are. Maybe that'll eventually come out.
Yeah, I think it will. All right. The Sun has reported that Paul McCartney has rewarded the East Sussex family who returned his lost Hofner bass a hefty six-figure sum. It was given to Kathy Guest, who found the instrument in her loft. It comes after weeks of negotiations with Paul's music company, MPL. The bass is said to be worth £10 million. So nice to see that this woman was rewarded quite heavily for returning the bass. A brand new book comes out on Paul's birthday, June the 18th, called When We Was Fab, The Beatles' Australasian Tour 1964 by Greg Armstrong and Andy Neal. As June will mark the group's 60th anniversary of their historical and hysterical Australasian tour, it remains deeply significant to the baby boomers who witnessed it firsthand and the millennials who wish they had been there for it. This tour is continuously celebrated as a major social landmark for Australia and New Zealand, a huge and lasting step in the advancing development of youth culture and a major highlight of the Beatles' remarkable career. The book is described by Amazon as the definitive and highly illustrated, with many previously unseen photographs, an account of this extraordinary tour by the world's most creative and influential musical force, the key moment in the coming of age of Australian and New Zealand youth as they embrace the cultural explosion of the 1960s. Another book coming out this year is called Off the Ground, Paul McCartney in the 1990s by J.R. Moores. Amazon describes it as a sympathetic but clear-eyed exploration of Paul McCartney's work in the 1990s, arguably his most important since the rise of the Beatles. That's how they describe it here. That book is due out November 12th. On March the 19th, an updated version of the Beatles Monopoly game was released to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Beatles' debut on The Ed Sullivan Show. The Op Games company unveiled a revamped edition of the Beatles Monopoly, complete with customized artwork highlighting various Beatles albums and legendary career moments, such as the band's sold-out show at the Hollywood Bowl in 1964. All right, now on July the 28th, a special event will be happening in which the Pete Best Band and The Circle will be performing at the Valleydale Ballroom in Columbus, Ohio. It's actually a full day packed with events. There'll be a lecture first with Pete Best and his brother Rogue discussing Pete's years in the Beatles at 2:30, followed by a meet and greet at 4 o'clock. The Circle will perform at 6 o'clock and the Pete Best Band at 7:15, and then a merchandise sale and an autograph signing with Pete Best and or The Circle. There are pricing levels for such an event and also an all-day pass. If you're interested, you can visit this website, valleydaleballroom.com. That's Valley, Valley, Dale, ballroom.com. And The Circle's new album, Revival, was just released a couple weeks ago. It's available to order at bigstirrecords.com. Don Daneman is still with the group, and you might recall they were recently, I think it was last year, at the Fest for Beatle Fans as a guest. Now, there is an all-star country band called The Frontmen, made up of Richie McDonald, formerly of Lone Star, Larry Stewart of Restless Heart, and Tim Rushlow, formerly of Little Texas. They just released a new album with a song called Beatles and Eagles. It's a song about a guy who's broken up with his girlfriend, and when going through the boxes she left behind, he found Beatles and Eagles albums. And it's a good night to play some Beatles and Eagles music. It's quoted as saying it's going to be a Beatles and the Eagles under the needle kind of night. Lots of references to Beatles and Eagles songs and the names of members of both groups in the song. If you're also an Eagles fan, you should love this song. It's from their self-titled album, The Front Men. And many thanks to Scott O'Rourke for that information. A week from last Friday, an online auction ended of a trove of letters, photos, and items owned by Patty Boyd that we mentioned here on this show. And the sale surpassed all expectations. Christie said the online sale of the Patty Boyd collection sold for around £2.82 million, roughly $3.6 million, roughly seven times the pre-sale high estimate of around £380,000. There were 111 lots up for sale, including affectionate letters from her rock husbands, George Harrison and Eric Clapton, along with clothing, jewelry, drawings, and photographs, some of Patty, some by Patty. The biggest individual sale was the original artwork that Clapton chose for the front cover of the Derek and the Dominoes Layla album, which sold for £2 million, roughly $2.5 million, 33 times the pre-sale estimate.
Wow.
That's one successful auction right there. And speaking of Patty Boyd, we sent happy birthday wishes to her. On March 17th, she turned the big 80. In an interview with American songwriter Danny Harrison, who just released his first new album in 6 years, Inner Standing, he says that he plans on releasing a video from two concerts he gave at the London club Omiera. That was in October 2023, and the concert video could be part of a deluxe version of Inner Standing. Danny said he also plans on touring behind the album, but no dates have been announced yet. Thanks to Joanne Michaels for that information. And we're going to close with two passings of note to report. First, John Sinclair has died. John was a champion of legal marijuana, a counterculture hero and poet. He died last Tuesday of congestive heart failure at the age of 82. The Detroit News reports Sinclair was an influential activist who was best known for his fight toward legalizing marijuana and for his role as band manager for the MC5. The Davison native was also a champion of civil rights and co-founder of the radical anti-racist group, the White Panther Party. His representative, Matt Lee, says he was on the forefront of the marijuana movement, that's for sure. But I don't think people realized how knowledgeable he was in American music, and he was a certified expert in all forms of American jazz and rhythm and blues. John Lennon wrote and recorded the song John Sinclair to help support John, who had been sentenced to 10 years in jail for possession of two joints. As the song says, they gave him 10 for two. John and Yoko headlined a benefit concert to free John Sinclair at the Chrysler Arena in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with supporting acts Bob Seger and Stevie Wonder. The event lasted 14 hours and drew 15,000 people. And 3 days later, Sinclair was released from prison after serving less than 3 years. The song John Sinclair ended up on the John and Yoko Elephant's Memory album sometime in New York City in June of 1972, and that was long after Sinclair was freed from prison. The song was later covered by the band Blind Melon. And Matt Lee also said he was definitely on the cutting edge of counterculture. When you look at how other towns had their Abby Hoffmans and their Jerry Rubins and those people, he was the Detroit equivalent to them. He was definitely Detroit's resident radical. And Sinclair leaves behind a huge body of work in the form of books and recorded poems and essays backed by blues and jazz musicians. His last book, Collected Poems, 1964 to 2024, is currently at the printer, set to be released anytime now by M.L. Liebler at Ridgeway Press. Mm.
I like the end of the Times obit. I don't know if you read it. They're talking about how, you know, now marijuana is legal. And someone says to him, so, John, it looks like everything's come around full circle. And he said, yeah, it would have been better if they gave back all the weed they took.
Good sense of humor there. And finally, very sorry to report of the passing of musician, record producer, and songwriter Mark Spiro, who wrote songs with Julian Lennon, including Saltwater and the very recent Every Little Moment, as well as writing for John Waite and for Heart and Cheap Trick. He died from cancer on his birthday. And Julian wrote, I am devastated that I will never see him again, laugh with him again, be creative with him again, but I am so thankful to have known him and his incredible loving family. Saltwater wells in my eyes, and the tears roll in between. End of quote. And speaking of Julian, on a positive note, happy birthday, Julian. It's his birthday today, April
Right.
8th.
Yeah. Hey, happy
And
birthday.
he turned 61 today.
And for Julian, I'll put these back on. All right, enough of that. One thing I want to just jump in here very quickly. I hope I can describe this. About a week or two ago, I started seeing people on Facebook posting their and Citizen, if I can hold, wow, that's not working. Citizen of Newtopia identity card. Okay. This I think might be sort of a sub website. Is there such a thing? There is now. To John Lennon's site, and perhaps a way to begin the promotion for the Mind Games box set. The website is go to, no, it's not. It's just it's just citizenofnewtopia.com. And you go there and you basically, I'm sure, signing up just for on to be on a mailing list. And you get an identity card, which I'm trying to show you here, but the glare, maybe if I hold it a little, you could sort of. Anyway, after you fill it out, you get the email with your membership number. Nothing really fancy attached. You're allowed to put, when you sign up, a little quote that gets printed, I guess, on the website. You know, and I put something like "War is over, with peace and love." I'll connect Ringo's slogan with. So I shared it on Facebook, and today, during the eclipse, while I'm getting emails and texts from people, I get notifications that it was taken down on my two Facebook pages because I guess it was spammy in their eyes. Something about maybe what I wrote about peace and war is over, and evidently the Citizen of Newtopia ID offends the Facebook hierarchy. So they pull those down off my Facebook pages. But the crap that I get sent from them and the friend requests that come on a daily basis, that's okay. But like a little John Lennon
So they're
potion.
anti-utopianites.
Maybe they something. I wish I don't have the reason given to me on why. Maybe I could get it really quick here on why it was. Oh, thank you. No, I don't want you.
In Carrollville,
All
Texas.
right, I'll maybe share it next week on what the reasoning was for pulling those posts down off my Facebook page. Basically, I was soliciting likes or something in a shady way. But I don't know if anyone else had this experience. If they signed up, got this certificate, and just popped it on Facebook for the heck of it. And then now it's, I'm not in any trouble, I don't think, with Facebook, but just a little weird.
Well, to take a page from Arlo Guthrie, we should start a movement. Everyone watching this should download their Newtopian identity card and post it on Facebook.
It's citizenofnewtopia.com is what I think. Citizenofnewtopia.com. Don't type go to citizenofnewtopia.com and see what happens. But
So
it
you think.
probably, again, is like an early stage of beginning the promotional ball rolling for the Mind Games release.
So you
Cool
think that the
website.
reason why this was taken down was because you're helping promote the
Uh,
Mind Games
maybe
album?
my
or
maybe
political.
phrase what I wrote, because you can put a slip if you wanted to.
Yeah.
When you sign up, they allow you to put something. I just, well, I guess it could it be construed as being a political message? I guess. You know, war is over with through peace
Facebook
and love.
Is
something
full of
hard.
Political messages.
Yeah, something like that. And it was taken down off both my pages. And I got the notification today, like a week or two later. So I don't know if that's happening to anyone else out there. So I just thought I'd bring it up. But so that's it for the news, Ken.
That is all.
That's it for the news. And it is time to jump into the body of the show with a very, very special guest, author Dana Klausner.
I'm Paul Muldoon, a poet who, over the past several years, has had the good fortune to record hours of conversations with one of the world's greatest songwriters, Sir Paul McCartney, reflecting on everything from the Beatles to Wings. The result is our new podcast, McCartney, A Life in Lyrics. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you, Ken. And now on to a very special guest that we have been threatening to have on for months and months now. And just with scheduling, and it got very busy for us on the show late last year. And then we had the downtime while Alan put to finish, Alan and Adrian, the finishing touches on volume two of the McCartney Legacy. So what was potentially going to happen in the fall is finally happening today. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome our special guest for this edition of Things We Said Today, author Dana Klausner. Hello, Dana.
Hi, Darren. I'm thrilled to be here. Been waiting a long time. I should
Well, Dana's book has been out now. It came out last year, right?
Came out in August.
Published in the fall, I think.
August. Yeah, last August.
I think it's backwards. I don't think you can see, but it's fine. Beatlemania lives on. Super fans in the 21st century. It's Dana's book. And if you look closely, why, my goodness, look at the picture in the center. That's me and Ringo and my daughter, Emily, who I believe was about 11 or 12. And the publisher chose that to be one of the pictures on the cover. And I was very honored. And we'll talk about why, the why, what, and how of that picture and the book with Dana today on Things We Said Today. So again, welcome, Dana. And congratulations on what isn't your first book, but this is your first music book, right?
No, this is my first book, but I've been a journalist for a very long time. I was a feature writer and columnist for the Baltimore Sun. I've had essays in Chicken Soup for the Soul and on Next Avenue, but this is my first book of my own.
Actually, how much writing have you done in the past that involved music or musical artists or anything? Have you done any?
No.
So it's interesting that for your first book, you would choose something that you hadn't, a topic that you hadn't touched on in your career as a writer.
You know what it is? I've been a Beatles fan since birth. And, you know, one day I got another writing book in the mail. I'm always trying to learn more about writing. I've been a writer, you know, for as long as I can remember. And I've been in many, you know, publications and had many staff writing jobs. And I got a book in the mail. And my daughter said to me, you know so much about writing, you should write a book. And I said, you know what? I want to write a book about the Beatles, because I thought I had read every book there was. But apparently, you know, I stopped my collection in the 70s, so I missed so much. But my book isn't about the Beatles. It's about the Beatles fans that are still, you know, following the group and watching podcasts like yours now in the 21st century. And you're in the book, and other Beatles DJs are in the book, and there's tribute bands. And there's people that met at International Beatle Week in Liverpool and got married. And there's what else? Help me, Darren.
I'm sorry, I think the audio crack broke up a little there.
Okay. So there's people that met and married at Beatle Week. There are people that are fans that have followed Paul around the world. There's a woman in particular that follows him around the world, but she doesn't have any money. So she sleeps in airports and lives on peanut butter sandwiches. There's crazy stories. There was a fan that was pregnant and her water broke, and her doctor said she needed a C-section to avoid an infection. And she said, not today, because she wanted her baby to be born on Paul McCartney's birthday, which was the next day. So she delayed it a full day so he'd be born on Paul's birthday. Yeah,
Incredible.
there's all sorts of stories like that.
Wow. What I love about your book is that you pointed out that you stopped collecting Beatle books decades ago.
Right.
And I remember when I was growing up in the 70s, there weren't many. And I had two that were like Bibles for me. The Beatles Forever by Nicholas Schaffner, and there was a book by Ron Schaumburg called Growing Up with the Beatles. I think that was his last name, Schaumburg. And it was his story. It was kind of like his autobiography, growing up, coming of age, and following the Beatles and collecting their music. There's been a boom, I don't know, maybe over the past 20 years. And there have been so many books coming out on the Beatles to be able to find one that has a unique topic, something that hasn't been covered. Is admirable. And your book takes a look at the fans today and what keeps them fans. And so when it's time to start accumulating these stories, where do you begin? Where was the starting point for you?
Well, what happened, the way I came up with the story, it was many years before I actually started writing it. I was a fan in a bubble. I didn't know any other fans. I grew up in the 70s. It wasn't the thing, everybody's listening to Donna Summer and the Bee Gees. So I knew in my head there were millions of people, but I didn't know anybody. And the first time I went to Liverpool was about 2004. And I didn't know anything. I just typed in things to do in Liverpool, and it came up with the Magical Mystery Tour bus. So I got on the bus, and the bus was sold out with people from all over the world speaking all different languages, with the one thing they had in common was they knew every lyric to every Beatles song. And at that point, I knew there was a story in that. So when my daughter said, "You should write a book," I said, "Okay, I'm writing that book." So I started it by just typing in, I was living in New York, and I just typed in Beatles walking tours in New York City. And I came up with someone very well, Susan Ryan, who's one of the co-coordinators of the Fest for Beatles Fans in New York. So Susan came out to Long Island very graciously and talked and talked and talked. We talked for 2 hours, and she became my Beatles sister. And it just went from there. She gave me five people, and so on and so on and so on, like that old commercial. But then also I just started Googling people, and I found Bill Heckel at the Cavern Club in Liverpool. Charles Rosanay was a big help, connecting me with tribute bands, Clark Gilmore. No one said no. No one said no. When I asked I just was looking at a Beatles Facebook group, and I just typed in, has anyone here ever met a Beatle? And you chimed in, and I said, "Would you like to be in the book?" And you said yes. No one said no. It was amazing.
And also one of my colleagues at WFUV Radio, New York City radio icon, Dennis Elsis, is also in your book. Dennis interviewed John Lennon in 1974 at WNEW FM. So I think after we were finished talking, Dana, then I put you in touch with Dennis, and he I think we're very close to each other in the book. But I did make it a point to tell Dennis, not only am I on the cover, but my story comes first. Ah.
Well, Dennis very kindly connected me with Peter Asher, and I actually got to meet Peter Asher in his home in Malibu, which was such a thrill. And he was just so nice, and he had these little dogs that were just running around, and it just felt so homey and comfortable. It was great. And then also Tom Frangione's in the book, and Ken Daschle.
Right,
So,
Q104.3 in New York City. So was this a type of doing this show with Alan, we see the pressures of writing with deadlines upon him and books that are a little beyond I'm like coloring book level when it comes to reading. But Alan's, he got a hard deadline. In fact, we had to shut the show down, as I mentioned up the top, for a couple of weeks. Did you have, were you piecing this together over time, or did you
Yes.
immediately go to a publisher and have a hard finish line put up for you?
When I went to the publisher, I thought I was done. At that point, I had 50,000 words done. And very happily, they accepted the book, but they said, oops, our minimum is 75,000 words. So it took me 4 years to write 50,000 words and 3 months to write it 50% more, 25,000 words. So yeah, it was an effort, but it was so much fun. Every story gave me chills. And, like my kids couldn't be in the room when I was interviewing because I was just the biggest fan going, oh my God, that can't be real. So yeah, it was just so much fun.
Alan, Ken, who, eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Ken, you have a question?
Yeah, I want to touch on something that we've talked about here on this show with Darren, and you kind of agree. And you just said it a few moments ago that it was tough to be a Beatle fan in the 70s. And I really find that kind of hard to believe because in the 70s, you had the height of the Beatles' popularity with their solo careers. You had Wings being so popular with album after album, so many hits. You had the Red and the Blue collections come out in 1973, which were, they did phenomenally well. And you had compilations like Rock and Roll Music. You had hits galore from the Beatles, especially from the solo careers. You know, there used to be that running joke. Did you know that Paul was in a band before Wings? So I remember when I was in high school through all that, and some friends of mine were into Wings. You know, and your experience was the opposite of that, despite all that
So,
success.
yeah, so opposite. And Susan actually said the same thing that, people would tell, she's a big John Lennon fan, and people would tell her, oh, he's old enough to be your father, and it's your parents' music, and why would you listen to that? And, and I was getting the same kind of thing, like, oh, Beatles are, so dead, they're broken up. And, it was disco. Disco was the thing where I went to school. I went to school on Long Island, and it was Saturday Night Fever just came out, and it
Oh.
was either disco or Led Zeppelin.
And for me, going to grammar school in the Bronx, it seemed like it was all Kiss on this side, disco on the other, and in the middle there were the disco fans who liked Kiss. And then there was me with into Wings. Literally, I'm not joking. I'm into Wings. And everyone else is into Kiss or disco, except Kevin McNamara, like the Allman Brothers band. But Kevin was in with the kids that made the trouble, so he was left alone. I wasn't, but it wasn't. I don't recall the Beatles being front and center at all
No, they
in the
definitely.
step.
That's really strange, you know, when you consider you being in the number one market in New York City while all this is going on. How could the charts not reflect, you know, the popularity at that time of the young kids in school?
Yeah, it's an interesting debate on why that is. Now, Dana, you're from Long Island originally, and Ken, you are as well. But there's maybe an example of different cultures in this country that have different tastes and different traditions or whatnot. And where I came from in the Bronx, it was all it seemed to be. It just was. It was Kiss. It was disco, and there was no. It didn't matter who was on the charts. The Bee Gees were the disco fans like them. There was lots of graffiti on our notebooks. Disco sucks, and lots of Kiss logos. I was very good at drawing the wings. W. That seemed to kind of go away when I got to high school. In the early 80s, that it started to become a little bit more, I don't know, it was a wider breadth of artists that people were fans of. Maybe it's because I was so young, we were young in the 70s, and when at such a young age, you haven't totally developed tastes yet. So whatever was big in the media at the time
Yeah.
has
I'm going
what.
to say to all of you kids, it is so great to be a geezer who grew up in the 60s. We didn't have to worry about the popularity of anything else because nothing approached the Beatles. And the ones that did, the Stones and other groups and early Zeppelin, I mean, that was okay. But the Beatles were still the zenith of Western civ, as in fact they are. So thank you. Thank you for finally letting me discover what's great about being old.
Well, my experience is not what you went through, Darren, and you, Dana. But and when you talk about disco, just for a second here, disco really took started to dominate the second half of the 70s, really. I mean, 74, there were signs of it, but from 75 on, you had Casey and the Sunshine Band and Donna Summer and the Bee Gees and all of that. But the first half of the 70s, there was a lot of rock
Yeah,
and
but I was in
pop.
high school the second half.
What's that?
I was in high school the second half of the 70s. I graduated in 1980, so.
That's
And
probably why we think so much of disco as being part of the 70s, but it wasn't there the entire decade.
no, but
Anyway.
like in my case, I'm the extreme case here because I didn't get to high school until the fall of 79. So I had all of that, all of the 70s were
Right.
from kindergarten to eighth grade. And it really was, I guess, in my case, probably what was popular, what was on the radio, what was on television, and that's what fed the tastes of the people I associated with, my friends. There was a few Beatle fans here or there. Friend of mine, a close friend of mine, we've got into Wings through me. But it was nothing compared again to the pockets of, the Kiss folk and the disco fans and, but anyway, it is interesting how through the decades, different groups, different cultures picked up on different things.
Okay. I just want to say one of the stories that I enjoyed reading in your book, Dana, was the first one with Lawrence Juber. And Lawrence has always been one of the kindest people and gracious, and anytime I need an interview with him, he's there. But what struck me about what he said in your book was what he learned from being with Paul McCartney that went beyond the music. And that is that family comes first. And he observed that with Linda and with the kids, and he decided to be the same way with Hope and with his kids. So little things like that, I really appreciate learning in the book from
Yeah,
Lauren.
and then there's the whole story of how he and Hope met. Did you get a chance to read about that?
That was through the
Well,
Ringo.
she's Sherwood Schwartz's daughter, and Sherwood Schwartz created Gilligan's Island and the Brady Bunch,
Right.
which shaped our generation and my generation. And she was a huge Beatles fan. And then John Lennon's murder knocked her out, and she was depressed and not getting out of bed. And she grew up in Beverly Hills, and her mom at her wit's end said, "Just go get your hair done. Just go do something. Get your hair done." So just to make her mom happy, she got out of bed, went to the hair salon, and the hairstylist said, "Oh, you look so sad." He said, "Go take a walk around the block, and when you come back, I'll have finished with my client and we can talk." So she's walking around the block with her head down, moping around, and she bumps bang into somebody. She sees boots. She looks up. It's Ringo. So she says to Ringo, "I'm just so sorry about John," and starts to walk away. And Ringo says, "Hold on." He says, "I can see this has really struck you hard." He says, "What I'm doing to get through it is I'm really throwing myself into my work." So, she gets her hair done. Her dad created the Brady Bunch. He was working on a new show, The Brady Brides. She was also trying to be a writer. She just graduated college. He asked her to work on the show. Normally she would say no because she wanted, a name for herself. She didn't want to ride on his coattails. But because of what Ringo said, she said yes. So being on the lot, this and that and this and that, she met people. She started dating Robin Williams. Robin Williams went to New York to film World According to Garp. She went to New York with him, was waiting for him to be done with an interview at a bar. and was talking to a woman sitting next to her at the bar. And the woman said, "Oh, you know, three of my friends are here. They're musicians. You know, you should meet them." So the three guys start walking, and in the middle is Lawrence Juber. She says it was like a movie, blurry dissolve. No one else appeared in the room. She still didn't know that he was Paul McCartney's guitarist. They went to dinner. She went back to his apartment. She saw a big poster of Wings, and she's looking, and there he is. And the rest is history. They've been
That is
married, what,
story.
over 40 years?
Right.
Yeah. I had no idea that she dated Robin Williams.
I
Yeah.
forgot that.
Wow. She's got a story to tell right there.
And then it's funny because then as the years went by, Lawrence was very involved in the music end of the shows that Hope's dad was developing, and some of the Brady Bunch sequels or films. And Hope was in at least one episode, right, of the Brady Bunch, I
Well,
believe.
she didn't tell me that. She told me that she became story editor of the Brady Brides. You know, she rose through the ranks.
I think
I don't
she
know if she was on an episode.
a
I'm
little
pretty
bit
sure.
part
Yeah, I thought that she dated Greg
In
in one of the
an
episodes, I
episode,
think.
something like that. Something, yeah. I've seen it. I think I've seen a still photo on probably on Facebook. But that's great. That's great. And Lawrence was, I'm sure, wonderful to talk with, and giving you a little bit of an inside scoop, being that he was inside, actually. But anyway. So both of their stories separately are in the book. She's in the section of Love Is All You Need, you know, people that met because of their obsession with the Beatles. So both of their stories are in the book. And then there's an even better story about their daughter. You know, Hope, Lawrence was working with George on Shanghai Surprise, and Hope's favorite Beatle was George. And she had some connection to all the other three and never got to meet George. So he promised her she could go to the studio and meet him. But the day she was supposed to go to the studio, she went into labor. So as they say, instead of "Here comes the sun," it was "Here comes the baby." And then 2 days later, she did get to go to the studio with 2-day-old Ilse. George picked up the baby, danced around with her, and then said something in Sanskrit and kissed her on the head. And they asked what he said, and he said he gave her the gift of music. And now she's an award-winning songwriter.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I know that she wrote something recently for Harry Styles' album, and
Yeah,
she's
she's actually worked with many people in a very short period of time
yeah.
and done at least one album of her own.
Yeah. Very talented family. No doubt about that. I really appreciate the whole section where you devoted to DJs. Because to me, this world of people who are continually exposing the Beatles music, talking about it on the radio, whether it's a radio show or a podcast, that's what keeps the interest going. It's one of many things that keeps the interest going. And so many of these people, I mean, for example, you had Ken Daschau, who's been doing his show for 20 years on Q104. Darren here, who's been on the radio for 40 years now. Dennis Elsis, 50 years, more than that. Going back to, WNEW and even before that. And Tom Frangione, who's been on Sirius XM for how long now? It's been a while, something like maybe 10 years.
Has it been what year did this did the channel launch? Do you remember? Because it was probably a year or two after it started. Tom may have been behind the scenes though at first before he came on the air. I mean, in a way, we the DJs are kind of. I mean, some of the fan stories in your book, Dana, are wonderful because they're wonderful coincidences or incredible accidents. In a way, for the DJs, we cheated in a way because we had a little bit of an in. We had a way to kind of break the ice a little bit, which was the case. I know you mentioned a couple of my stories in your book. One of them was pretty much the result of being a WFUV, and the other had absolutely nothing to do with my career. But I don't know if you want me to in a nutshell, go tell, what's in Dana's book, if I should do it now. But the one, of course, that I always remember is the accident, the happy coincidence that had nothing to do with my career, which I actually didn't have a career at the time. I was at WFUV, had no clue that it was going to be practically a lifelong thing. My family, my parents owned a house on Eastern Long Island in East Hampton. My dad was a fisherman. So in 79, he bought this very small, rickety house in the Spring section of East Hampton. And pretty much over the years, through the 80s, fixed it up himself with a friend's help. And well, me, I was to, dig the holes in the backyard for the bushes. So McCartney's in-laws, the Eastmans, lived on Lily Pond Lane in East Hampton at the time. I'm not sure if they're still based there, but so you had seen the local paper, the East Hampton Star, and Dan's papers, blurbs every once in a while that Paul McCartney and Linda were seen at this restaurant, or maybe there was some ritzy party going on and the McCartneys were there. So in 1988, I believe I was aware going into that summer that Paul was out had rented a place in Amagansett, which I think he was using for rehearsals, perhaps for Flowers in the Dirt, the recording sessions. So I was in the car one day with my parents. Very cool. You're in your early 20s and you're out in the Hamptons with your mom and dad in your dad's rickety old Jeep. Now, this Jeep was 11 from the day he bought it. It was apple green from 1975. Everything went wrong with this car that my father bought. I felt bad for him. I mean, you drive, the wheels would fall off for no reason. I mean, so because he was a fisherman and tended to drive up on the beach and spend lengthy periods of time right on the shore. The chassis was pretty well rusted after just a short period of time. So we're heading towards Montauk. I'm in the back seat. My father's taken the side streets to avoid Montauk Highway through East Hampton and Amagansett. And we come out on 27, which is Montauk Highway, and avoid all the little village traffic. Just Hampton and Amagansett again. So as we're coming out of one of the side roads in Amagansett, approaching 27 Montauk Highway, a car goes by, and I see a woman with blonde hair in the back seat, and I thought it looked like Linda. Nah, couldn't, and she seemed to be acknowledging somebody that was outside the car in the road. Within seconds, my mother in the front seat says, that looks like Paul over there. I'm like, no, it can't possibly be. It was Paul McCartney across on the other side of the highway on his bicycle with James and some of James's friends. So, and cars are slowing down and beeping, and he's waving at everyone passing by. Montauk Highway out there is a two-lane highway. And he eventually makes his way across the street and he's heading right for where my father's truck is in the intersection. And I can't get out of the car because the door is rusted shut. The back door, I don't even know how I got in the car. I probably was crawling in through the tailgate in the back, crawl over the back seat, which if I did that today, I'd end up in the hospital for a week. But couldn't get out of the car, rolled the window down. Halfway down, the glass falls into the door because inside the door there's nothing that's, the metal is all rotting out. I can't get out of the car. I'm putting my shoulder into the door. trying to get out. My mother, meanwhile, jumps out of the car and she corners Paul as he comes across the highway. And I hear her saying, "Paul, Paul, my son is a big fan. He's been a fan of yours since he was a baby." And finally, I reach out and I open the door from the outside button. That worked somehow. And I get out of the car. And why would my father have a legal pad in the car? I don't know. So he quick tosses the pad at me and he starts yelling out to Paul, "Hey, Paul, my son's a big fan of yours. He's got your records are all over the house." Completely had to blow Paul's mind, like, who are these people? And it was a blur. He scribbled his name on it on the legal pad, Paul McCartney. He said, "You have very nice parents, but I got to go because his son and their friends kept going on the bikes." They didn't stop. They just kept going down. It was a country road, but still. And Paul looked like he had just rolled out of bed, white, dirty t-shirt, shorts, hair wasn't combed. I can't picture him anymore, even after even the rest of the trip out to Montauk. It was like it immediately became a blur. And that was that. You know, Ringo was through FUV. It was arranged meetings backstage, interview in 2003. That's kind of boring, but the McCartney story was a classic only because in typical DeVivo family fashion, car doors don't open and the window, like I said, the window, you see, you just have to catch the window when you rolled it down. It was a two-hand job. Catch the window so it doesn't fall down in the door, because then you got to open the door up to get the glass out. But it was his Jeep he fished in, and that stayed on the road for many years, even after that. So that was my little... After that story, Dana thought, maybe this book isn't such a good idea.
That was one of my favorite stories, because it was just so funny. You know, it was like a skit. I even said in the book, you would think this was on Saturday Night Live. You know, it was just so funny. Some of my favorite stories are people that got on stage with Paul during a concert or during the soundtrack and got his autograph and then got it tattooed. And one of my favorites is Nina Galper. And I don't, you might know her, Darren, because she goes to the fests all the time, but she got his autograph on her foot. So there's a great picture of her with her foot all the way up his thigh and she is dying. But yeah, these stories are great. And the through line to every story is he makes you so comfortable. You're in front of tens of thousands of people, but you're just talking to him and all your nerves disappear and he makes you comfortable and he's humble. And no one has ever said, you know, they're nervous getting up to the point of meeting him. And then once they meet him, he just makes it a normal conversation. I don't know if that would happen to me. I think I would faint, but that's the story I hear.
There's also the mother and daughter that went on stage.
Right.
All signed their backs.
The same place on the back of their right shoulder. You know, the mom was a fan her whole life. And then, of course, she instilled it on her daughter. Her daughter was vegetarian since fourth grade because of Paul. Yeah, they got on stage together and got the same autograph in the same place. What I like about Nina's story, too, is she's a I don't know exactly what her title is, but she works at cancer centers. So she wears ballet flats. And she gets people, you know, people are always interested to hear the story of her tattoo. So she makes, you know, people having chemotherapy and other stages of cancer, everybody smiles and rubs the tattoo and loves the story. So it's just so sweet.
That's great. Ken, anything else?
Why don't we let Alan ask a question?
You're on the air, Alan.
Okay. You know, I was wondering when, you know, you have all of these stories and there's a huge mix of people, many of whom are professional people, you know, ranging from Lawrence Juber and Peter Asher to the radio people and the guys in the Sounds Alike bands, and a lot of them are just regular old people who get autographed. Or one of my favorite stories was a record signing story where the woman walks up to him, gets him to sign the album, goes off and loses it, and her husband is behind her online, And Paul says, "Who should I sign it to?" And he says, "My wife, she's over there losing it." And he says, "You're a good man." A little bit like what he said to Darren, you know, but you've
You're a
got
good
great
parent.
parents, you know.
I can only imagine thinking when this woman comes flying out of this apple green Jeep, and her son is trying to bust through the back door. Anyway, sorry,
So
Alex.
the question was basically with this range of people and experiences, when you started it talking to Susan and getting your first lists, did you envision having the kind of divisions that you have, and how did it just organized itself as you went on?
I had no clear path. I had no outline. I didn't know how to find people. Like I said, I didn't know any Beatle fans. Along the way, I would talk to one person from a tribute band, and I'd say, well, there has to be more, And then I found Charles Rosanay, who collects the audition tapes for the, I believe, just for the American tribute bands, and sends them over to Clark Gilmore at Cavern City Tours, who puts together International Beatle Week. So, in that way, so I spoke to Charles and put his story in. He runs tours from New York to Liverpool and London, and then he connected me to the tribute bands. And then while I was interviewing Bill Heckel, who's the director of Cavern City Tours, he said, "Oh, we run International Beatles Week, and there are some people that have met there and fell in love and got married." I said, "Oh, well, that would be fantastic. Could I interview some of them?" So it just kind of snowballed that way.
I was mildly surprised that in the beginning of the book you talked about Joe Rufano from Liverpool Shuffle being one of the people who put you on to things, but when you got to the Liverpool Shuffle section,
It
you
wasn't
opted
Joe.
to Frank Vanelli instead. And so I was sort of actually looking forward to reading about Joe Rufano because he actually played at my wedding, and so did Liverpool Shuffle. But he also played on his own during the ceremony. So I thought, oh, let's read Joe's backstory here, and it never was in there. It
Well, it's
was,
time for the
maybe that
sequel,
was an
I guess.
outtake. When the next edition comes out, you can add Joe.
Time for the sequel. It's funny. I've been going to, I went to the Beatles Fest in New York, Fest for Beatles Fan in New York, and I went to Beatles on the Beach in Delray Beach, Florida. Everybody that comes up to buy a book has their own story. It just never ends. There are just so many stories. So, yeah, either a sequel or a podcast or something.
That's why you were able to come up with that last 25,000 words in just a few weeks after that. It is incredible. Everyone does have a story, and some of the time I was reading it thinking, well, I don't know, does someone who does this professionally count as a super fan? But yeah, I guess so, why not?
It starts with the fandom and then they do it professionally.
Right.
Everybody in the tribute band started, following the Beatles when they were young, and one person went to see Beatlemania when he was a teenager and realized, hey, wait, I can do that. I can be a Beatle, and then there's a man who was in that Beatlemania show that he saw, so it all kind of rolls together. But it all starts with the fandom. Even Vivek Tiwari, who he's a Broadway producer, he just produced Jagged Little Pill, huge show, and so he wrote The Fifth Beatle about Brian Epstein, but it started when he was young and a Beatles fan, and that's how he found the path to Brian Epstein, who actually influenced him to get into the arts, because what he says is, a young Indian man is supposed to become a doctor or an engineer, but he always wanted to be in the arts, and he didn't know a way to do that. And when he saw Brian Epstein in his mold of being, this businessman, and then he found the Beatles in a basement, So yeah, it was his influence that made him be what he is.
Was there ever any temptation to, once you began getting so many of the professional people, to sort of like the non-professional people that people wouldn't know of being edged out of the book, or did you always want to
Oh,
maintain a
no,
balance?
because those are some of my favorite stories because
That's true.
they're dreamy. It could be anybody. I've still never met any of them, and it just makes me feel like, oh, one of the through lines through the book is, oh, I'm one step closer to that Paul hug. And I went to see Ringo in West Virginia in October, and I'm calling Darren frantically, can you get me
Oh,
on stage? Yeah, so it's the
my,
dream.
oh, I couldn't. Was it,
how easy or difficult was it to sell this to a publisher? Did they quickly see the value of a study of fans as opposed to the Beatles themselves, or did they recognize that this was a niche that hadn't been really explored too much?
Well, first I went trying to find an agent route. I was trying to, follow the rules. But agents just didn't have the vision. They kept saying, you need the background, you need the history. And I would say, well, there's thousands of those. I think Beatles fans know all that, and that's not really what the book is. So yeah, I found this publisher, it's McFarlane Publishers, and they do a lot of pop culture. And yeah, it was days when they answered me. I sent the query, and days later they answered. So you have to have the vision, and I really appreciate that they did.
Do you have another project coming up?
I have some in mind. I was thinking about doing like a Beatles collector, but from the point of view of getting in touch with the big auctioneer houses and finding the big items, and then finding the people who bought them and why they would spend, tens of thousands of dollars and what it all means to them. And then also, I thought, connect it with different Beatles tattoos and why people got those tattoos and what it means to them.
When you mentioned the collector's thing, I mean, was it a conversation recently with someone about Butcher covers? And basically, everybody I know who has a Butcher cover, or sometimes several Butcher covers, has great stories about how each one of those Butcher covers was found. And there's probably a book in the Butcher cover.
Yeah, well, connect me to them. I'd love to do it.
Yeah, I love the one.
That's the best part for me. I get to hear these stories. I always wished I was born earlier and I was there for it. And I get to hear the stories, and it's just such a thrill.
You
More
should
than once,
probably heard the people that got in yard in garage sales. Oh, I bought this Beatle album for $2. Guy didn't know what he had. It's a Butcher cover. I'm like, why can't I find a
right.
Butcher cover in the flea market in the garage sale? Instead, I find Slim Whitman's greatest hits.
I know
But you have your
someone who got
story.
a Butcher cover when the album came out and ended up bringing it back to the store because she wanted her album to be like all of her friends'
Oh,
copies.
God. Oh, my God.
I was going to say, Dana, you should have you should try and find out who bought that Beatles painting that just sold. Of images of a woman, because it's the only painting that we know of where all four of them collaborated together.
I
That was
don't know if I'm
just on
familiar with
auction.
that. What's that story?
They worked on it when they were in the Tokyo Hilton Hotel when they were performing in '66 for several shows in Tokyo, and they had to stay in their room most of the time. And when they did, the promoter brought over a lot of materials for them to paint and a sheet of paper, and they worked on it on this table with a lamp in the middle, and they all made their own individual painting.
Wow. And that's a soul.
Yeah, just a couple of months ago, we were
Oh.
talking about it here on this show.
Wow.
Dana, doesn't that sound like when your kids were little and you brought a box of crayons when you go to the restaurant and have them draw on the back of the other side of the placemat? Here,
Sure.
picture for me and stop you making noise.
You're making me crazy. Here's a crayon. Yeah, yeah.
That's
Yeah,
too.
or a snow day, or a rain day. Yeah.
Many of the people that you mentioned in your book are all friends of ours, or people that we've interviewed here on the show. Like
Really?
you mentioned Charles Rosanay, who I've known since the late 80s.
Yeah.
And Peter
Yeah,
Asher, we've interviewed.
Vivek was on late last year.
Right. And I wanted to thank you for the authors that you brought into the book because I work with Kit O'Toole
Okay.
on the podcast show of Talk More Talk. And it's kind of interesting what's said in those few pages on Kit because she likes to bring up the fact that because she's a big Michael Jackson fan, that even though she heard Beatles music growing up as a kid, she didn't really latch on to that music. But because Paul worked with Michael Jackson,
Oh,
she
wow.
started to listen to more of Paul's music because of Michael Jackson. You know, but that's not even mentioned there. But it's kind of interesting.
She didn't tell me that. Yeah, what's interesting to me, I have some what I call kids in the book. My son's best friend. My son is now 28, but when I interviewed Nick, I don't know what they were in their early 20s, and Nick was the biggest fan. He knew more than me. And it's amazing how these kids are coming up, and it's not necessarily coming from their parents. They're finding the music on their own and they're relating to it on their own. He went to a 3-day festival. He brought my son. And that's where I found out about the tattoos. So they went to this festival called Firefly Festival in Delaware, maybe.
You're
And
right.
it was a 3-day festival with like electric punk bands and like whatever. I don't even know what they listened to, but Paul was the headliner. And that's what drew Nick, and he was 19 years old. And they didn't bring me, but he said the tickets were $200 for the whole weekend. And he said, everybody stayed for Paul. And Nick and my son and Nick's girlfriend, they waited 4 hours right up next to the stage. And then, like, it just filled 2 football fields full of kids to watch Paul.
That happened at Bonnaroo, to Bonnaroo Festival. Paul had headlined, I think, one day, and I heard from someone who was there the unbelievable lines all day just to have a chance to be near the stage where Paul was amongst all of these younger bands and younger artists. There may have been one other, like, quote unquote, heritage artist on the bill, maybe headlining another night at Bonnaroo, but McCartney, almost positive, was Bonnaroo. And it was like everyone got it and wanted to experience it. And it pretty unique. And it's just, again, another generation.
Yeah, it'll never end. It'll never end. And Nick, he's followed him around a little bit. And there's another girl that actually we lived in Maryland for a little while before we moved back to New York, and she used to live next door to me. She was 3 years old when I lived next door to her. Now she's in her 20s and she's the biggest fan. And her first job, she's a journalist now, and her first freelance story was the local nonprofit station in Baltimore held a rooftop-like concert during COVID. They ended up putting it on a boat because they couldn't do the logistics. But she wrote the story of that when she was in her early 20s, quoting the rooftop concert as if she was there from watching YouTube
I also
videos.
wanted to mention Jude Kessler, who I've interviewed several times, and you
He's
talk
such a
about
sweetheart.
dedication.
Oh my God.
I didn't know the full story of it. It took her 18 years to finish her first book. Wow.
That's dedication.
It sure is.
And now
And
she has like
just about
50
every
books.
little detail in her books.
Yeah. Yeah,
Amazing.
she puts all the factual information into novel form. So she writes them like stories, but everything's a true fact, and then she footnotes it all. Painstaking work, but they're beautiful.
I just joked that she has 50 books, but actually, how many are, what is she up to in her John Lennon series?
I'm
Is
not
it
sure, maybe nine?
nine?
No, I think she wanted it to be nine books. The most recent one, which I've been giving away on my website, is the fifth volume, Shades of Life, Part One. And I think her next book is either done or it's almost done.
Right, and she just made an audiobook.
Right. That was for the third volume called She Loves You.
And these, if you're not familiar with Jude's books, I mean, they're
Yeah.
substantial.
Yeah.
Remarkable. And she
And
is a sweetheart.
she's such a sweetheart.
I wanted to say this, someone who deserves a ton of credit is John Bazzini, who you include in the book, because I mentioned his name in almost every one of our shows in the news, because when it comes to finding out anything about Beatle books, what new ones are coming out, he has, I wish I could see his whole collection. He lives in Connecticut. He doesn't live too far from me. I'm hoping to, get together with him and see his collection. But he collects anything that's printed on the Beatles, any magazines, any articles about them. He's probably got most of the Beatle books that have been written at this point, so he's very familiar with them. So anytime I need new information about what books are coming out, it's a very good chance it comes from him.
Yeah, he has mine. I believe I sent him an autograph book. If I didn't, I will. Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks for including him in the book.
Oh yeah, of course. I think Charles introduced me to him.
Sense.
Yeah.
Dana, I wanted to ask you if to put you on the spot, could you pick out one, maybe two, stories that you cover in your book that are were the ones that maybe surprising, a big surprise isn't a good description, but really maybe took your breath away or made you laugh the hardest, or can you narrow it down to one or two that you would say these are my favorites? Let's put it like that.
Okay, well, one of my favorites is Walnut Ridge. The story of how the festival there started. You know that story, right, Darren?
Yeah, but refresh.
So the town was going bankrupt. I don't remember what year it was. I think it was 2010. The town was going bankrupt. They were having a city council meeting on, how to revitalize the town, and somebody there remembered that the Beatles did a secret landing there in 1964. They changed planes in the middle of the night because Brian Epstein wanted to take them to a resort or a spa somewhere in the middle of the country just for a breather during their first tour. So they changed planes in the middle of the night, thinking no one would see them. But three guys like came out of a college classroom or drove by. And one of the guys was best friends with the now mayor's sister. The mayor at that time was 10 years old. And his sister was the president of the Walnut Ridge Beatles fan club. So the kid that drove by and saw the Beatles called her. And the word spread until there were reporters. So when the Beatles were coming back around, Charles Snap, and he's this country man, he just brings into this story, he says, everybody, you're supposed to go to church on Sunday, but it was the Beatles, so we knew we had a reprieve. And he says, the crowd was bigger than a football stadium. It was 300 people. And then, he says, like, so the mayor got on the top of the car and says, everybody has to behave. So anyway, there's these amazing pictures that his sister took from that day that I don't know if they're published anywhere else. They're in the book. Anyway, so they parlayed that fact into, is it called Beatles at the Ridge? What's it called? Abbey Road on the River? I'm not sure what that one's called. I should have looked it up.
It's the Beatles on the
Beatles
River.
at the Ridge?
No, you're thinking of Abbey Road on the River.
Abbey Road on the River. It's
No,
the one in
that's
Arkansas. It's the one in Arkansas.
yeah.
It's Walnut Ridge, Arkansas. So, they made like a Beatles statue, 20 foot tall Beatles statue. They made the festival, and now, the town's in black, and 10,000 people come every year. And the Beatles saved the town. That's my favorite story. The one that gives me chills is when I met Bill Heckel at Cavern City Tours. First of all, it was such a dream, So I go to the Cavern Club. I'm at the wrong door. So he sends, his assistant to come get me and bring me to, I mean, like, this man could have been a Beatle. And I'm just dying, I'm just a ball of nerves. And I get up there, and Bill Heckel, the director of Cavern City Tours, takes me into the boardroom, which they spell BORED. So right there, you're comfortable. And normally, like, I take capricious notes and I barely look up, but he says, the Beatles are more popular than Shakespeare. If I asked you to quote a Beatles lyric, or if I asked you to quote Shakespeare, you would know the Beatles lyric. You wouldn't know the Shakespeare lyric. And I looked up, I'm like, okay, I have to listen to this. And I turned on record, didn't take a note. And then his stories were amazing. When he was 16, he was a child, and he had two 16-year-old aunts from two different families. And both of them, one of them hadn't been to school in 4 months. And her mother found out because the school called and said, "Oh my God, we're so sorry. She's so sick. Is she in the hospital? How is she?" Mother said, "There's nothing wrong. What are you talking about? She hasn't been to school in 4 months." And it turns out when the parents left for work, she would go to her friend's house, change out of her school uniform, put on mini skirt and boots, and go see the Beatles play at the Cavern Club. Cut school for 4 months. The other auntie did the same thing with work. She would go see the Beatles during lunch and come back late from work and lost her job. And the grandma was furious because, her job was important to the family. But those stories just give you chills. You're just there in the moment. And then he was just so kind. He gave me, tickets to the Cavern Club and tickets to the Magical Mystery Tour bus, and it was a dream. I'm just the biggest, like, silliest fan, so
I kind of envy all the Beatles fans that got to see the Beatles at the Cavern many times.
There's a couple of stories of fans that got to see the Beatles live at Shea and in Philadelphia. Yeah, those stories give you chills.
Did you find when you were interviewing people in Liverpool that a lot of people who were fans of them in their very earliest days kind of maintained that passion for them, or did they just sort of did a lot of
Well,
them?
what Bill Hackle told me is, there was a turn because, John moved to London, and then the people in Liverpool felt slighted. So, they kind of turned against the Beatles, and that's when his aunties gave him all their Beatles records, and he became a fan. And then sadly, everybody turned back after John's murder.
Do you
Tanya,
think? I'm sorry, go ahead.
no, I was going to say, I was throwing it to you.
Do you think that the Beatles, in a way, are kind of bigger now than they've ever been? I mean, nothing can compare to how it was in the 60s as it was happening. And you got to witness every song and every album, and it was an event, not to mention the tours and the movies and all that. But when you consider the fact that there's hardly ever a week that goes by when I'm not on the internet and I'm looking at Yahoo's main page and there's a story about the Beatles or there's a story about one of them. And there's still a lot of radio programs on the Beatles. There's more and more podcasts than ever before on the Beatles. The Beatles books never stop coming out. I think there's more coming out now than there ever has been before. And with people finding new angles to write about them. So, and then you hear about how well they're doing on Spotify and people streaming their songs, young people streaming their songs. There's a lot of Beatles tribute bands out there. So your book touches on all of that in a way.
Yeah.
So do you think that the Beatles are even bigger now than they were?
Well, I think it's twofold. I think, the music itself draws people in, but then I think their message is just so powerful. With the country so divided, with everything going on in the world, I think their message is more powerful now, perhaps, than it was then. And part of it is just the arc of their story. They came up in a way that bands don't come up anymore. Like, I have a musician friend that tells me it's more like selling your business to a label than somebody goes to a club and says, "Oh my God, this band is amazing." They just don't come up the way they did. And I think the story of how they came up, the brotherhood between them, is amazing. Everybody would love to have a friend group like that. There's just so much to it.
And I think just about every single Beatle fan, while I'm sure they love all four Beatles, can identify with one of them more than the others. So I think that also helps in their appeal, their wide appeal.
And I think they're a connector. I think somebody had told me, and I really feel this, that it makes outsiders feel included. And they were such a connector back in the 60s. They wouldn't play at the Gator Bowl because it was segregated. and they wouldn't play until they what do you call it? Until they let everybody in together. I can't think of the word. But way back then they were inclusive of everybody. So I think it still speaks to people today. Integrated, that's the
All right, Alan, anything else?
Don't think so. Should we've done like an hour. Should we wrap it up?
Yes, I was gonna actually repeat a question that was asked already, the closing question. Like, I know Dana, you alluded to this already. What's next? Where do you go from here? Would you consider a volume two of this, or is this done? And if you did write another book on the Beatles, do you feel you want to go into, you were talking about the collecting possibility?
Well, the collecting possibility, I think, would be more along the same lines of, how the Beatles shaped their lives and why they wanted to become a collector, and then the great stories of how they found these things. But it would be the same kind of line. And then, it's been suggested to me that I should start a podcast and have people tell their stories. I love hearing people's stories. And, for me, the goal is to have my own story. I'm actually going to see the concert in the Hollywood Bowl on Thursday, and I'm going to bring a book with me and try to pass it along. Hopefully I'll have my own story to tell one day.
Okay. That's the tribute to Jimmy Buffett.
Right.
Right.
Oh,
Just
nice. Very nice.
doesn't didn't know what referring to.
Kind of like a behind the scenes question. What was the experience like for you writing your first book? Easier, harder? Did you meet challenges you didn't expect? What was that like after doing lots of like articles, right? Freelance work. Now your first book, you came away with that with what? Like, for example, I'm asking you this because I've said this before. I've been toying with writing a book. Okay. I just learned how to spell and I want to use my skills. And it's like, but what am I getting into? So
Right.
from
Well,
your perspective, what was the experience like writing this first book?
for me, I did it in a way that I knew how to do it. I interviewed people and then wrote essays regarding their interviews. So it's more like a lot of long form articles put together into an anthology, because that's the way I know how to do it. I took it in short pieces.
Right.
I'm trying to learn how to do, a long form novel kind of thing. I never looked at it as, oh, I have to write 200 pages, because that's way too overwhelming. So I would look at it as each interview, were about 3,000 words.
I mean, Alan, someone like Alan, like, and I'm serious, there's an intimidation factor there. You know, Alan writes, the McCartney Legacy is going to be five volumes when all is said and done. Okay. It have the second coming of Harry Potter here, folks. And these aren't, these, you know, and the amount of, how do you just keep that energy, the focus? Geez, I'm just interested. How do you stay awake? I mean, when when I know there had to be a time for you, Dana, when you're coming down to the end, when you do have a deadline now on you, and there are things you want to change, and you don't know if you're going to have enough time to make those changes, and there were changes that were made, I'm sure, that you don't like, and you wish you could slip them back in there when no one's looking. I mean,
Yeah,
just.
actually, to be honest, they really didn't change anything. They kept my words, which is amazing to me. It was daunting. When they said write 25,000 words in 3 months, I had no idea how I was going to do that. I just kept it churning, and it was scary. Sometimes I'd be up till 6 in the morning biting my nails. But when it's over, it's good. A writer always says, the worst part about writing is writing, and when it's over, that's the good part.
Like banging your head against the wall, you
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
stop, it feels so good.
Right.
But also, when you're a writer, and especially if you're writing about the Beatles or something you really love doing, everything you do is tax deductible.
I'm just learning that now, actually. So, yeah.
Well, Dana, thank you so much. We apologize for this having taken so long to schedule, but it's been a joy, and thank you so much for being our guest and for being
No, I
such a
really appreciate you having me on. I love your show. And this is just a thrill. This is another, there's been so many pinch me moments since the book's been published. And this is another one.
Oh,
Oh, we have to say
volume
where
two.
to.
If you do a volume two, we've got plenty of people we could lead you to.
Oh, I would love that. I really would.
And
So let's say where the book, where they can buy the book. So I have a website where they can buy personalized autographed copies, which is beatlemanialiveson21.com. 21 is for 21st century. And then if they don't want a personalized copy, they can go to Amazon or all the book sites, Barnes and Noble, my publisher, McFarland, Thrift Books. But you should buy from me because then you're supporting me and you get my autograph and it could be worth something.
exactly, right?
Dana, you should consider signing the book and have Darren sign it with you. Can you imagine what that will go for on eBay?
That would be pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, no, you may have to end up paying your own shipping then. And there's Emily. I think I told you, and it might be then in the credits, her age or the year. I think she was around 11 or
I
12.
think you told me she was 11. Yeah.
This was at Westbury Music, well, whatever it's called now.
Yeah,
It was
NYCB
their name
Theater.
every week. But what was Westbury Music Fair on Long Island, by complete chance, I think I asked Ringo's publicist, my daughter's a fan, she's going to come. And it was like, oh, okay, fine, no problem. Wait a minute, don't you want to hear the whole, I prepared this whole thing to get you to let me backstage.
Well,
But
you
that
have the story of where Emily, when she was younger, drew a picture for Ringo,
yeah,
right?
I think that I may have probably used that to kind of, here's part two of this. 23rd in 2003, when Ringo Rama came out, Ringo was doing publicity. That's when I got to interview him at the Carlisle Hotel. And I think I got 20 minutes with him, and he had like an internal clock. Like when that 20 minutes was up, Ringo sprung like he was spring loaded off the chair, said goodbye, and went out the door. For that interview at that time, my daughter, who was four years old, maybe five, I don't remember how old she is now, let alone back then. She had this really wicked hip infection that warranted them going in and cleaning out the infection out of them. She was in a body cast for 2 months. And around that time, the interview happened. She loved Ringo and she drew him a picture. And I brought it and to the interview. And he signed a copy of Goodnight Vienna to Emily. And he signed my copy of the Ringo Rama to Darren. And I felt bad for my engineer. Because Ringo kind of had, even then, the strict rules with his signatures. He wouldn't personalize anything. And my engineer, Chris, broke out a copy of his dad's White Album. And Ringo said, nope, not going to personalize it. And he just scribbled his name on it. So I said to Chris afterwards, I said, see, you should have had your father draw a picture for Ringo. Maybe then he would have personalized the White Album. And that's then several years later, we're backstage at Nassau, Westbury Music Fair, where this picture was taken. We had front row seats, Emily and I, and Westbury Music Fair in the round. And at one point, the stage would come very close to where we were sitting. Ringo reached in and grabbed a handful of Emily's popcorn out of her bucket, was eating the popcorn. Somebody was playing the guitar solo, I guess.
That's in the book.
Yeah, did she save the bucket?
She
Darren?
did. I probably did.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. But
Yeah,
that was that. But that was also unexpected. That was like, did he just do what I think he did? So, anyway, it's stories like that, fun, lighthearted in the stressful times we live in today. Pick up a copy of Beatlemania Lives On, super fans in the 21st century. Dana Klausner wrote it. Dana, thank you so much for coming on Things We Said Today and spending a little time with us.
And thank you.
We want to have you back, so get working. I mean, you know, what a pleasure having Dana Klausner on as a guest on today's Things We Said Today. As I mentioned during the show, we've been trying to get her on since the fall. I'm glad we were finally able to make it happen. One more time, the book is Beatlemania Lives On, Superfans in the 21st Century. So pick that up, published by McFarland Books. So let's go round the horn and tell the good folks things they need to know about us individually. Ken?
First of all, my other podcast, Beatles Podcast, which is Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles videocast. Our next show, which will be on April the 15th, tax time, will be part two of a series here. Rolling Stone just published, Rob Sheffield compiled his list of the top 100 solo Beatles songs. So last week, we discussed songs 100 through 51. Next Monday, April 15th, we'll go from 50 to number one. Find out what song was rated the number one best solo Beatles song of all time. And it's not Newtopia National Anthem.
No. Because then they'd take the Rolling Stone article off Facebook then.
Okay. Or you could just cheat. Just go online and look. But if you want something more suspenseful.
It was a cool list.
Hmm?
It was a cool list, even though it really didn't make, it seemed rather random, but it was a fun list.
There's a great mixture of hits and a lot of deep cuts. And some songs you'd be surprised were even in.
Yeah.
True. The top 100. So if you can, please subscribe to our channel. We're on YouTube every Monday night at 9 p.m. live, 9 p.m. Eastern. Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast. Ken Michaels Radio, my YouTube channel, which is loaded with all kinds of interviews and conversations on the Beatles. My most recent show was with Luca Perassi, who put out the book Paul McCartney, Music as Ideas. The stories behind the songs from 1970 to 1989, and we discussed the Press to Play album. There'll be new shows coming very soon, I promise you. Also, Every Little Thing, my radio show, which is on some 50 radio stations right now. You can listen to the last two shows that aired on radio station WFDU. They're in their archives, so you don't have to listen at a specific time. You have 2 weeks to listen to each show. Once it's on their website, go to wfdu.fm on their archival page and type in Every Little Thing. And then there's my website, kenmichaelsradio.com, with lots of interviews on there as well. Those are strictly audio interviews. And then there's my Beatles trivia page, where you can win great prizes like the McCartney Legacy. You notice, by the way, on our show, Alan always has the McCartney Legacy behind him right there, and I got mine right over there. We kind of bookend the top part of the screen this way.
Nice. You know?
Make me look bad. Yes.
You've got to put your copy above the furniture behind you.
When you just sidetracked very quickly, when the first book came out and the cover was red, I'm assuming a plan had been put in place where the books were going to each have a different unique color.
Basically, but we hadn't decided what the other colors would be. We have now for right. The next one, which is, you know, blue.
Red. Oh, right, blue.
Red and the blue.
All right. That's it, Ken?
That's it.
You sure?
All I got for you. Yeah.
Got something for us, Alan?
Yeah, you know, if you want to get in touch with me, I got two Facebook pages. Just Alan Kozen or Alan Kozen Remixed. You can get in touch with us by email, all of us, at thingswesaidtodayradioshow@gmail.com. And we have, from our many Facebook pages, we're now focusing on one, which is Things We Said Today Video Podcast. right?
Yes, Things We Said Today video podcast. The right now, the cover photo on the Facebook page is the cover of the McCartney Legacy Volume 2,
Yeah.
and it's blue. That's maybe right now. I'll leave it alone there. That's the page you're looking for. Please like us or follow us there. And the other, at least one of the pages, older pages, will eventually be shut down, just so that we could consolidate everything into one place. And I want to apologize in advance. I realized a little while ago I was making all kinds of Eclipse posts, and I actually shared everything on the Things We Said Today page as well. So that stuff's there now. But please join us at the new page. Things We Said Today video podcast.
And the new
All
show
right.
will be there. Well, by the time you hear this, you'll have probably gotten it from the page. We're on YouTube. Please like our or follow our page if you haven't already, or subscribe to it, whatever it is that they call it there. We're on Podbeam. Subscribe to us there too. Podbeam distributes to everyone else, including Apple. So we're all over the place and not hard to find. And once again, that email address, if you want to write to us, things we said today, radio show at gmail.com.
Right. And as for me, you could catch me on WFUV Monday through Thursday night, starting at 10 p.m. till 2 a.m. and Saturday afternoons from 1 until 4. This coming Saturday, the radio station's spring membership drive is going to begin. Our on-air fundraiser will last through next week. Friday, I don't know what the date is, but from this coming Saturday to the Friday after, we'll be fundraising. And you can go to WFUV.org, our website, where you can also listen to us and you can make a contribution. And my on-air schedule is going to be completely different during that week. So I'll put that stuff on my Facebook page if you care. Actually, I put it on my Facebook page as a way to remind me what I need, where I need to be and when. Those are my on-air hours, FUVs at 90.7 FM in New York City, or you can stream us at WFUV.org, or get our app, another way, cool way to listen to us. And also two Facebook pages. I notice I've been doing this the whole show. The camera's right here. The two Facebook pages, Darren DeVivo and Darren DeVivo, WFUV DJ, Beatle Podcaster. Get in touch and we'll stay in touch then. And that's about it for this week's edition of Things We Said Today. We'll see you in all likelihood in 2 weeks. For Ken Michaels, for Alan Kozin, I'm Darren DeVivo. And again, thank you so much for spending time with us on Things We Said Today. Later.